My brother and sister are getting used to it, so they're okay, but Deidre doesn't feel that way, and I don't think her parents do either.
I patted Sam's shoulder because I didn't know what to say. He gave me a little smile and then a hug. He said,
"You've been a rock, Sookie."
And then he stiffened. Sam's nostrils flared.
"You smell like there's a trace of vampire,"
he said, and all the warmth had gone out of his voice. He released me and looked at me hard. I'd really scrubbed myself, and I'd used all my usual skin products afterward, but Sam's fine nose had picked up that trace of scent Eric had left behind. "Well," I said, and then stopped dead. I tried to organize what I wanted to say, but the past 40 hours had been so tiring. "Yes," I said. "Eric was over last night." I left it at that. My heart sank. I thought of trying to explain to Sam about my great-grandfather and the trouble we were in, but Sam had enough troubles of his own. Plus, the whole staff was feeling pretty miserable about Arlene and her arrest. There was too much happening. I had another moment of sickening dizziness, but it passed quickly, as it had before. Sam didn't even notice. He was lost in gloomy reflection, at least as far as I could read his twisty shapeshifter mind. "Walk me to my car," I said impulsively. I needed to get home and get some sleep, and I had no idea if Eric would show up tonight or not. I didn't want anyone else to pop up and surprise me, as Murray had done. I didn't want anyone trying to lure me to my doom or shooting guns in my vicinity. No more betrayal by people I cared for, either. I had a long list of requirements, and I knew that wasn't a good thing. As I pulled my purse out of the drawer in Sam's office and called goodnight to Antoine, who was still cleaning in the kitchen, I realized that the height of my ambition was to get home and go to bed without talking to anyone else and to sleep undisturbed all night. I wondered if that was possible. Sam didn't say anything else about Eric, and he seemed to attribute my asking him to escort me as an attack of nerves after the incident at the trailer. I could have stood just inside the bar door and looked out with my other sense, but it was best to be double careful. My telepathy and Sam's nose made a good combination. He was eager to check the parking lot. In fact, he sounded almost disappointed when he announced there was nothing out there but us. As I drove away, in my rearview mirror, I saw Sam leaning on the hood of his truck, which was parked in front of his trailer. He had his hands in his pockets, and he was glaring at the gravel on the ground as if he hated the sight of it. Just as I pulled around the corner of the bar, Sam patted the truck's hood in an absent-minded way and walked back into the bar, his shoulders bowed. Chapter 13. "Amelia, what works against fairies?" I asked. I'd gotten a full night's sleep, and I was feeling much better in consequence. Amelia's boss was out of town, so she had the afternoon off.
"You mean something that'll act as a fairy repellent?" she asked.
"Yeah, or cause fairy death, even," I said. "That's preferable to me getting killed. I need to defend myself."
"I don't know too much about fairies, since they're so rare and secretive," she said. "I wasn't sure they still existed until I heard about your great-grandfather. You need something like mace for fairies, huh?"
I had a sudden idea.
"I've already got some, Amelia," I said, feeling happier than I had in days.
I looked in the racks on the door of the refrigerator. Sure enough, there was a bottle of real lemon.
"Now all I got to do is buy a water pistol at Walmart," I said. "It's not summer, but surely they've got some over in the toy department."
"That works?"
"Yeah, a little-known supernatural fact. Just contact with it is fatal. I understand if it's ingested, the result's even quicker. If you could squirt it in a fairy's open mouth, that would be one dead fairy."
"Sounds like you're in big trouble, Sookie."
Amelia had been reading, but now she laid her book on the table.
Yeah, I am.
You want to talk about it?
It's complicated, hard to explain.
I understand the definition of complicated.
Sorry.
Well, it might not be safe for you to learn the ins and outs of it.
Can you help?
Will your wards work against fairies?
I'll check my sources,
Amelia said in that wise way she had when she didn't have a clue.
I'll call Octavia if I have to.
I'd appreciate it. And if you need some kind of spellcasting ingredients, money is no object. I'd gotten a check in the mail that very morning from Sophie Ann's estate. Mr. Cataliades had come through with the money she'd owed me. I was going to run it to the bank this afternoon, since the drive-thru would be open. Amelia took a deep breath, stalled. I waited. Since she's an exceptionally clear broadcaster, I knew what she wanted to talk about, but to keep our relationship on an even keel, I simply held out until she spoke out loud.
I heard from Trey, who's got a couple friends on the police force, though not many, that Whit and Arlene are denying up and down that they killed Crystal. Arlene says, they planned on making you an example of what happens to people who hang around with the supernatural, that it was Crystal's death that gave them the idea. My good mood evaporated. I felt a profound depression settle on my shoulders. Hearing this spoken out loud made it seem even more horrible. I could think of no comment to offer.
What does Trey hear about what might happen to them? I said finally.
Depends on whose bullet hit Agent Weiss. If it was Donnie's, well, he's dead. Whit can say he was being shot at, so he shot back. He can say he didn't know anything about a plan to harm you. He was visiting his girlfriend and happened to have some pieces of wood in the back of his pickup.
What about Helen Ellis?
She told Andy Balfleur she just came to the trailer to pick up the kids because they'd done really well on their report cards, and she'd promised to take them to the Sonic for an ice cream treat. Any more than that, she doesn't know diddly squat. Amelia's face expressed extreme skepticism.
So Arlene is the only one talking.
I dried the baking sheet. I'd made biscuits that morning. Baking therapy, cheap and satisfying. Yeah, and she may recant any minute. She was real shaken up when she talked, but she'll wise up. Maybe too late. Or at least we can hope so.
I'd been right. Arlene was the weakest link.
She gotten a lawyer?
Yeah. She couldn't afford Sid Matt Lancaster, so she hired Melba Jennings.
Good move, I said thoughtfully. Melba Jennings was only a couple of years older than me. She was the only African-American woman in Bon Temps who'd been to law school. She had a hard-as-nails facade and was confrontational in the extreme. Other lawyers had been known to take incredible detours to dodge Melba if they saw her coming.
Makes her look less of a bigot.
I don't think it's gonna fool anyone, but Melba's like a pit bull. Melba had been in Amelia's insurance agency on behalf of a couple of clients.
I better go make my bed, Amelia said, standing and stretching.
Hey, Trey and I are going to the movies in Clarice tonight. Want to come? You've really been trying to include me on your dates. You're not getting bored with Trey already, I hope.
Not a bit, Amelia said, sounding faintly surprised.
In fact, I think he's great. Trey's buddy Drake has been pestering him, though. Drake's seen you in the bar and he wants to get to know you.
He aware?
Just a guy. Thinks you're pretty.
I don't do regular guys, I said, smiling. It just doesn't work out very well.
It worked out disastrously, as a matter of fact. Imagine knowing what your date thinks of you every single minute.
Plus, there was the issue of Eric and our undefined but intimate relationship.
Keep the possibility on the back burner. He's really cute, and by cute, I mean hotter than a steam iron. After Amelia had tromped up the stairs, I poured myself a glass of tea. I tried to read, but I found I couldn't concentrate on the book.
Finally, I slid my paper bookmark in and stared into space, thinking about a lot of things. I wondered where Arlene's children were now. With Arlene's old aunt, who lived over in Clarice, or still with Helen Ellis? Did Helen like Arlene enough to keep Kobe and Lisa? I couldn't rid myself of a nagging feeling of responsibility for the kids' sad situation, but it was going to have to be one of those things I simply suffered. The person really responsible was Arlene. There was nothing I could do for them. As if thinking of children had triggered a nerve in the universe, the phone rang. I got up and went to the wall-mounted unit in the kitchen. "Hello," I said without enthusiasm.
"Miss Stackhouse? Sookie?"
"Yes, this is she," I said properly.
"This is Remy Savoy."
My dead cousin Hadley's ex, father of her child.
"I'm glad you called. How's Hunter?"
Hunter was a gifted child, God bless him. He'd been gifted the same way I had been.
"He's fine. About that thing."
"Sure."
We were going to talk telepathy.
"He's gonna need some guidance soon. He'll be starting kindergarten. They're gonna notice. I mean, it'll take a while, but sooner or later."
"Yeah, they'll notice, all right." I opened my mouth to suggest that Remy bring Hunter over on my next day off, or that I could drive to Red Ditch. But then I remembered that I was the target of a group of homicidal fairies. Not a good time for a youngin' to come visiting, and who's to say they couldn't follow me to Remy's little house? So far, none of them knew about Hunter. I hadn't even told my great-grandfather about Hunter's special talent. If Niall himself didn't know, maybe none of the hostiles had uncovered the information. On the whole, better to take no risks.
"I really want to meet with him and get to know him. I promise I'll help him as much as I can," I said. "Right now, it just isn't possible. But since we have a little time to spare before kindergarten, maybe in a month or so?"
"Oh," Remy said in a nonplussed way, "I was hoping to bring him over on my day off."
"I have a little situation here that I have to resolve."
If I was alive after it was resolved, but I wasn't going to imagine that. I tried to think of a palatable excuse, and of course, I did have one.
"My sister-in-law just died," I told Remy. "Can I call you when I'm not so busy with the details of—"
I couldn't think of a way to wrap up that sentence.
"I promise it'll be soon. If you don't have a day off, maybe Kristen could bring him?"
Kristen was Remy's girlfriend.
"Well, that's part of the problem," Remy said, and he sounded tired but also a little amused. "Hunter told Kristen that he knew she didn't really like him and that she should stop thinking about his daddy without any clothes on."
I drew in a deep breath, tried not to laugh, didn't manage it.
"I am sorry," I said. "How did Kristen handle that?"
"She started crying, then she told me she loved me, but my kid was a freak and she left."
"Worst possible scenario," I said. Do you think she'll tell other people?"
"Don't see why she wouldn't."
This sounded depressingly familiar, shades of my painful childhood.
"Remy, I'm sorry," I said.
Remy had seemed like a nice guy on our brief acquaintance, and I'd been able to see he was devoted to his son.
"If it makes you feel any better, I survived that somehow."
"But did your parents?"
There was a trace of a smile in his voice, to his credit.
"No,"
I said. "However, it didn't have anything to do with me. They got caught by a flash flood when they were driving home one night. It was pouring rain, visibility was terrible, the water was black like the road, and they just drove down onto the bridge and got swept away." Something buzzed in my brain, some kind of signal that this thought was significant.
"I'm sorry, I was just joking,"
Remy was saying in a shocked voice.
"No, no problem. Just one of those things,"
I said, the way you do when you don't want the other person to fuss about your feelings.
We left it that I would call him when I had some free time. That actually meant when no one's trying to kill me, but I didn't explain that to Remy. I hung up and sat on the stool by the kitchen counter. I was thinking about my parents' deaths for the first time in a while. I had some sad memories, but that was the saddest of all. Jason had been 10, and I'd been 7, so my recollection wasn't precise, but we talked about it over the years, of course, and my grandmother had recounted the story many times, especially as she grew older. It never varied. The torrential rain, the road leading down into the little hollow where the creek ran, the black water, and they'd been swept away into the dark. The truck had been found the next day, their bodies a day or two after that. I got dressed for work automatically. I slicked my hair up into an extra tight ponytail, making sure any stray hairs were gelled into place. As I was tying my shoes, Amelia dashed downstairs to tell me that she checked her witch reference books. "The best way to kill fairies is with iron." Her face was lit with triumph. I hated to rain on her parade. Lemons were even better, but it was kind of hard to slip a fairy a lemon without the fairy realizing it. "I knew that," I said, trying not to sound depressed. "I mean, I appreciate the effort, but I need to be able to knock them out so I could run away." I didn't know if I could stand to have to hose down the driveway again. Of course, killing the enemy beat the alternative, letting them catch me and do what they wished with me. Amelia was ready for her date with Trey. She was wearing high heels with her designer jeans, an unusual look for Amelia. "What's with the heels?" I asked, and Amelia grinned, displaying her excellent white teeth.
"Trey likes them," she said,
"with jeans on or off.
You should see the lingerie I'm wearing."
"I'll pass," I said.
"If you want to meet us after you get off work, I'm betting Drake will be there.
He's seriously interested in getting to know you, and he's cute, though his looks may not exactly appeal to you."
"Why? What's this Drake look like?" I asked, mildly curious.
"That's the freaky part. He looks a lot like your brother." Amelia looked at me doubtfully. "That might weird you out, huh?" I felt all the blood drain out of my face. I'd gotten to my feet to leave, but I sat down abruptly.
"Sookie? What's the matter? Sookie?"
Amelia was hovering around me anxiously.
"Amelia,"
I croaked,
"you got to avoid this guy. I mean it. You and Trey get away from him, and for God's sake, don't answer any questions about me."
I could see from the guilt on her face she had already answered quite a few. Though she was a clever witch, Amelia couldn't always tell when people weren't really people. Evidently, neither could Trey, though the sweet smell of even a half-fairy should have alerted a ware. Maybe Dermot had the same scent-masking ability that his father, my great-grandfather, did.
"Who is he?"
Amelia asked. She was scared, which was good.
"He's..."
I tried to formulate the best explanation.
"He wants to kill me."
"Does this have something to do with Crystal's death?"
"I don't think so," I said.
I tried to give the possibility some rational consideration, found my brain simply couldn't deal with the idea.
"I don't get it," Amelia said. "We have months, well, weeks, of nothing but plain old life, and then all of a sudden, here we are."
She threw up her hands.
"You can move back to New Orleans if you want to," I said, my voice faltering.
Of course, Amelia knew she could leave any time she wanted, but I wanted to make it clear I wasn't sucking her into my problems unless she chose to be sucked, so to speak.
"No,"
she said firmly.
"I like it here, and my house in New Orleans isn't ready anyway."
She kept saying that. Not that I wanted her to leave, but I couldn't see what the delay was. After all, her dad was a builder.
"You don't miss New Orleans?"
"Of course I do," Amelia said. "But I like it here,
and I like my little suite upstairs, and I like Trey, and I like my little jobs that keep me going. And I also like a hell of a lot being out of my dad's line of sight. She patted me on the shoulder. You go off to work and don't worry. If I haven't thought of anything by morning, I'll call Octavia. Now that I know the deal about this Drake, I'll stonewall him, and Trey will too. No one can stonewall like Trey. He's very dangerous, Amelia, I said. I couldn't impress that on my roommate emphatically enough.
Yeah, yeah, I get that, she said. But you know, I'm not any little honey myself, and Dawson can fight with the best of them.
We gave each other a hug, and I allowed myself to immerse in Amelia's mind. It was warm, busy, curious, and forward-looking. No brooding on the past for Amelia Broadway. She gave me a pat on the back to signal she was letting go, and we stepped back from each other. I ran by the bank, then I stopped at Walmart. After a bit of searching, I found one little rack of water guns. I got a two-pack of the clear plastic version, one blue and one yellow. When I thought of the ferocity and strength of the fairy race, and the fact that it took all I had to open the damn blister pack and extricate the water pistols, my chosen method of defense seemed ludicrous. I'd be armed with a plastic water pistol and a trowel. I tried to clear my mind of all the worries that were plaguing me. There was so much to think about. Actually, there was so much to fear. It might be time to take a leaf from Amelia's book and look forward. What did I need to do tonight? Which one of my ongoing worries could I actually do something to solve? I could listen in the bar tonight for clues about Crystal's death, as Jason had asked me to do. I would have done it anyway, but it seemed even more important to track down her killers, now the danger seemed to be piling up from all directions. I could arm myself against fairy attack. I could be alert for any more fellowship gangs. And I could try to arrange some more defense. After all, I was supposed to be under the protection of the Shreveport Ware Pack because I'd helped them out. I was also under the protection of the new vampire regime because I'd saved their leader's ass. Felipe DeCastro would have been a pile of ash if not for me. For that matter, so would Eric. Wasn't this the best time in the world to call in those markers? I got out of my car behind Merlot's. I looked up at the sky, but it was cloudy. I thought it was only a week after the new moon, and it was definitely full dark. I pulled my cell phone out of my purse. I'd discovered Eric's cell number scrawled on the back of one of his business cards, tucked halfway under my bedside phone. He answered on the second ring.
Yes, he said,
and I was able to tell by that one word that he was with others. A little shiver went down my spine at the sound of his voice. Eric, I said, and then wished I'd spent a little time framing my request. The king said he owed me, I continued, realizing this was a little bald and bold. I'm in real danger. I wonder what he could do about that.
The threat involving your older kin?
Yes, he was definitely with other people.
Yes, the, enemy has been trying to get Amelia and Trey to introduce him to me. He doesn't seem to realize I would recognize him, or maybe he's very good at pretending. He's supposed to be on the anti-human side, but he's half-human. I don't understand his behavior.
I see.
Eric said after an appreciable pause.
So protection is necessary?
Yes.
And you ask this as...
If he'd been with his own underlings, he'd have told them to leave so he could talk to me frankly. Since he hadn't done that, he was probably with one of the Nevada vamps. Sandy Seacrest, Victor Madden, or Felipe DeCastro himself, though that was unlikely. Castro's far more lucrative business ventures in Nevada required his presence most of the time. I finally realized Eric was trying to find out if I was asking as his bed buddy and wife, or as someone he owed big time.
I ask this as someone who saved Felipe de Castro's life, I said.
I'll present this petition to Victor since he's here at the bar, Eric said smoothly. I'll get back to you this night.
Great. Mindful of Vamp's extreme hearing, I added. I appreciate that, Eric.
As if we were friendly acquaintances.
Mentally dodging the question of what we actually were to each other, I tucked away the cell phone and went into work, hustling because I was a couple of minutes late. Now that I talked to Eric, I felt much more optimistic about my chances of survival.
Chapter 14.
I kept my mental ears open that night, so it was a hard evening for me. After years of practice and some help from Bill, I'd learned to block out most of the thoughts of the humans around me. But tonight was just like the bad old days, when I'd smiled all the time to cover the confusion in my head caused by the constant bombardment of mental mutterings. When I walked past the table where Bud Dearborn and his ancient crony, Sid Matt Lancaster, were having chicken baskets and beers, I heard,
"Crystal's no great loss, but no one gets crucified in Renard Parish. We gotta solve that case."
And,
"Got me some genuine werewolves for clients. I wish Elva Dean had lived to see this. She would have loved it."
But mostly Sid Matt was thinking about his hemorrhoids and his spreading cancer.
Oh, gosh, I hadn't known.
My next pass by his table, I patted the venerable lawyer on the shoulder.
"Let me know if you need anything,"
I said, and met his turtle-like stare with a blank face.
He could take it any way he chose, as long as he knew I was willing to help.
When you throw out your net that wide, you come up with a lot of trash. I found out over the course of the evening that Tanya thought she might be settling down permanently with Calvin, that Jane Boathouse thought she had chlamydia and wondered who was responsible, and that Kevin and Kenya, police officers who always requested the same shift, were actually living together now. Since Kenya was black and Kevin couldn't be whiter, this was causing Kevin's folks some problems, but he was standing firm. Kenya's brother wasn't too happy about her living situation either, but he wasn't going to beat up Kevin or anything like that. I gave them a big smile when I brought them bourbon and cokes, and they smiled back. It was so rare to see Kenya crack a grin that I almost laughed. She looked about 5 years younger when she smiled. Andy Belfleur came in with his new wife, Hallie. I liked Hallie, and we hugged each other. Hallie was thinking she might be pregnant, and it would be mighty early in the marriage for them to start a family, but Andy was quite a bit older than her. This maybe pregnancy hadn't been planned, so she was pretty worried about how Andy would take the news. Since I was laying myself out there tonight, I tried something new. I sent my extra sense down into Hallie's belly. If she really was pregnant, it was too soon for the little brain to be registering. Andy was thinking Hallie had been quiet the past couple of days, and he was worried something was wrong with her. He was also worried about the investigation of Crystal's death, and when he felt Bud Dearborn's eyes on him, he wished he'd picked any other place in Bonton for his evening out. The gunfight at Arlene's trailer was haunting his dreams. Other people in the bar were thinking about typical stuff. What are the all-time most popular thoughts? Well, they're really, really boring. Most people think about their money problems, what they need from the store, what housework they have to do, how their jobs are going. They worry about their kids a lot. They brood over issues with their bosses and their spouses and their co-workers and other members of their churches. On the whole, 95% of what I hear is nothing anybody'd want to write down in her diary. Every now and then, the guys, less often the women, think about sex with someone they see in the bar. But honestly, that's so common I can brush it aside, unless they're thinking about me. That's pretty disgusting.
The sex ideas multiply with the drinks consumed. No surprise there.
The people thinking about Crystal and her death were the law enforcement people charged with finding out who'd killed her. If one of the culprits was in the bar, he was simply not thinking about what he'd done. And there had to be more than a single person involved. Setting up a cross was not something a man on his own could handle, at least not without a lot of preparation and some elaborate arrangement of pulleys. You'd have to be some kind of supernatural to pull it off by yourself. This was Andy Belfleur's train of thought while he waited for his crispy chicken salad. I had to agree with him. I'd bet Calvin had already considered that scenario. Calvin had sniffed the body, and he hadn't said he'd smelled another were-animal of any kind. But then I recalled that one of the two men who'd been wheeling the body out had been a soup. As far as learning anything new, I was drawing a blank until Mel came in. Mel, who lived in one of Sam's rental duplexes, looked like a reject from the cast of Robin Hood the Musical tonight. His longish light brown hair, neat mustache and beard, and tight pants gave him a theatrical air. Mel surprised me by giving me a half hug before he sat down, as if I were a good buddy of his. If this behavior was because he and my brother were both panthers, but that still didn't make a lot of sense. None of the other were-panthers got cozy with me because of Jason. Far from it. The hotshot community had been a lot warmer toward me when Calvin Norris had been thinking of asking me to be his mate. Did Mel have a secret yearning to go out with me? That would be unpleasant and unwelcome. I took a little trip into Mel's head, where I saw no lusty thoughts about me. If he'd been attracted, he'd have been thinking them, since I was right in front of him. Mel was thinking about the things Catfish Hennessy, Jason's boss, had been saying about Jason and Bonton Auto Parts that day. Catfish's tolerance balloon had burst, and he told Mel he was thinking about firing Jason. Mel was plenty worried about my brother, bless his heart. I'd wondered my whole life how someone as selfish as my brother could attract such faithful friends. My great-grandfather had told me that people with a trace of fairy blood were more attractive to other humans, so maybe that explained it. I went behind the bar to pour some more tea for Jane Bodehouse, who was trying to be sober today because she was trying to compile a list of the guys who might have given her chlamydia. A bar is a bad place to start a sobriety program, but Jane had hardly any chance of succeeding anyway. I put a slice of lemon in the tea and carried it to Jane, watched her hands shake as she picked up the glass and drank from it. "You want something to eat?" I asked, keeping my voice low and quiet. Just because I'd never seen a drunk reform in a bar, that didn't mean it couldn't happen. Jane shook her head silently. Her dyed brown hair was already escaping the clip that held it back, and her heavy black sweater was covered with bits of this and that. Her makeup had been applied with a shaky hand. I could see the lipstick caked in the creases in her lips. Most of the area alcoholics might stop in Merlot's every now and then, but they base themselves at the Bayou. Jane was our only resident alky since old Willie Chenier had died. When Jane was in the bar, she always sat on the same stool. Hoyt had made a label for it when he'd had too much to drink one night, but Sam had made him take it off. I looked in Jane's head for an awful minute or two, and I watched the slow shifting of thoughts behind her eyes, noticed the broken veins in her cheeks. The thought of becoming like Jane was enough to scare almost anyone sober. I turned away to find Mel standing beside me. He was on his way to the men's room, because that's what was in his head when I looked.
"You know what they do in Hot Shot with people like that?" he asked quietly, nodding his head toward Jane as if she couldn't see or hear him. Actually, I thought he was right about that. Jane was turned so inward that she didn't seem to be acknowledging the world much today.
"No," I said, startled.
"They let them die," he said. "They don't offer them food or water or shelter if the person can't seek it for himself or herself."
I'm sure my horror showed on my face.
it's kindest in the end, he said.
He drew a deep, shuddering breath.
Hot Shot has its ways of getting rid of the weak.
He went on his way, his back stiff. I patted Jane on the shoulder, but I'm afraid I wasn't really thinking about her. I was wondering what Mel had done to deserve his exile to a duplex in Bon Ton. If it had been me, I would have been happy to be rid of the multiple ties of kinship and the microscopic hierarchy of the little cluster of houses huddled around the old crossroads, but I could tell that wasn't the way Mel felt about it. Mel's ex-wife had a margarita in Merlot's from time to time. I thought I might do a little research on my brother's new buddy the next time Ginger dropped by. Sam asked me a couple of times if I was okay, and I was surprised by the strength of my desire to talk to him about everything that had happened lately. I was astonished to realize how often I confided in Sam, how much he knew about my secret life. But I knew that Sam had enough on his plate right now. He was on the phone with his sister and his brother several times during the evening, which was really unusual for him. He looked harassed and worried, and it would be selfish to add to that load of worry. The cell phone in my apron pocket vibrated a couple of times, and when I had a free moment, I ducked into the ladies' room and checked my text messages. One from Eric. "Protection coming," it said. That was good. There was another message, and this one was from Alcide Herveau, the Shreveport pack leader. Trey called. "Trouble your way," it read. "We owe you." My chances of survival had risen considerably, and I felt much more cheerful as I finished out my shift. It was good to have stockpiled favors with both vampires and werewolves. Maybe all the shit I'd gone through last fall would prove to have been worth it after all. All in all, though, I had to say my project for the evening had been a washout. Sure, after asking Sam for permission, I'd filled both the plastic water guns with juice from the lemons in the refrigerator, intended for iced tea. I thought maybe real lemons would somehow be more potent than the bottled lemon juice at home. So I felt a little safer, but the sum total of my knowledge about the death of Crystal had not increased by one fact. Either the murderers hadn't come in the bar, weren't fretting over the evil thing they'd done, or weren't thinking about it at the moment I was looking inside their heads. Or, I thought, all of the above. Chapter 15. I had vampire protection, of a sort, waiting for me after work. Bubba was standing by my car when I left Merlot's. He grinned when he saw me, and I was glad to give him a hug. Most people wouldn't have been pleased to see a mentally defective vampire with a penchant for cat blood, but I'd become fond of Bubba.
"When did you get back in town?" I asked.
Bubba had gotten caught in New Orleans during Katrina, and he'd required a long recovery. The vampires were willing to accommodate him because he had been one of the most famous people in the world until he'd been brought over in a morgue in Memphis.
"About a week ago. Good to see you, Miss Sookie."
Bubba's fangs slid out to show me how glad. Just as quickly, they snicked back into concealment. Bubba still had talent.
"I've been traveling. I've been staying with friends. But I was in Fantasia tonight, visiting Mr. Eric, and he asked me if I'd like the job of keeping watch over you. I told him, 'Miss Sookie and me, we're real good friends, and that would suit me just fine.' Have you gotten another cat?"
"No, Bubba, I haven't."
"Thank God." "Well, I got me some blood in a cooler in the back of my car."
He nodded toward a huge old white Cadillac that had been restored with time and trouble and lots of cash. "Oh, the car's beautiful," I said. I almost added, "Did you own it while you were alive?" But Bubba didn't like references to his former state of existence. They made him upset and confused. If you put it very carefully, from time to time he'd sing for you.
I'd heard him do Blue Christmas. Unforgettable.
Russell give that to me,
he said. Oh, Russell Edgington, the King of Mississippi?
Yeah, wasn't that nice?
He said since he was king of my home state, he felt like giving me something special.
How's he doing? Russell and his new husband, Bart, had both survived the Rhodes Hotel bombing.
He's feeling real good now. He and Mr. Bart are both healed up.
I'm so glad to hear it. So, are you supposed to follow me home?
Yes'm, that's the plan. If you leave your back door unlocked, close to morning, I'll get into that hidey hole in your guest bedroom. That's what Mr. Eric said.
Then it was doubly good that Octavia had moved out. I didn't know how she would have reacted if I'd told her that the man from Memphis needed to sleep in her closet all day long. When I got home, Bubba pulled in right behind me in his amazing car. I saw that Dawson's truck was there, too. I wasn't surprised. Dawson worked as a bodyguard from time to time, and he was in the area. Since Alcide had decided he wanted to help, Trey Dawson was an obvious choice, regardless of his relationship with Amelia. Trey himself was sitting at my kitchen table when Bubba and I came in. For the first time since I'd known him, the big man looked seriously startled. But he was smart enough not to blurt anything out. Trey, this is my friend Bubba, I said. Where's Amelia?
She's upstairs. I got some business to talk with you.
I figured. Bubba's here for the same reason. Bubba, this is Trey Dawson.
Hey, Trey.
Bubba shook hands, laughing because he'd made a rhyme. He hadn't translated real well. The spark of life had been so faint by the time a morgue attendant of the fanged persuasion had gotten hold of him, and the drugs in his system so pervasive that Bubba had been lucky to survive the bringing over as well as he had, which wasn't too well.
Hey,
Trey said cautiously.
How are you doing, Bubba?
I was relieved Trey'd picked up on the name.
I'm real good, thank you. Got me some blood in the cooler out there, and Miss Sookie keeps some true blood in the refrigerator, or at least she used to.
Yes, I have some, I said. You want to sit down, Bubba?
No, ma'am. I think I'll just grab me a bottle and settle down out in the woods. Bill still live across the cemetery?
Yes, he does.
Always good to have friends close.
I wasn't sure I could call Bill my friend. Our history was too complicated for that. But I was absolutely sure that he'd help me if I was in danger. Yes, I said. That's always good. Bubba rummaged around in the refrigerator and came out with a couple of bottles. He raised them to me and Trey and took his leave smiling.
Good God Almighty,
Trey said.
That who I think it is?
I nodded and took a seat opposite him.
Explains all the sightings,
he said.
Well, listen, you got him out there and me in here. That okay with you?
Yes. I guess you've talked to Alcide?
Yeah. I'm not trying to get in your business, but it would have been better to hear all this from you directly, especially since you talked to Amelia about this guy Drake, and Amelia's all upset because apparently she's been blabbing to the enemy. If we'd known about your troubles, she would have kept her mouth shut. I would have killed him when he first introduced himself. Saved all of us a lot of trouble. You think about that?
Bluntness was the way to go with Trey. I think you are kind of getting in my business, Trey. When you're here as my friend and Amelia's boyfriend, I tell you what I think I can without endangering you or Amelia. It never occurred to me that Niall's enemies would think of getting information through my roommate, and it was news to me that you couldn't tell a fairy from a human. Trey winced. You may not want to be responsible for guarding me, with the personal complication of having your girlfriend under the same roof as the woman you're supposed to protect. Is this too big a conflict of interest for you? Trey regarded me steadily.
No, I want the job,
he said. And even though he was aware, I could tell that his real goal was keeping Amelia safe. Since she lived with me, he could kill two birds with one stone by getting paid for protecting me.
For one thing, I owe that Drake payback. I never knew he was a fairy, and I don't know how he managed that. I got a good nose.
Trey's pride had been bruised. I could understand that.
Drake's dad can mask his smell, even from vampires. Maybe Drake can, too. Also, he's not completely fey. He's half-human, and his real name is Dermot.
Trey absorbed this, nodded. I could tell he felt a little better. I was trying to figure out if I did. I had misgivings about the arrangement. I thought of calling Alcide and explaining why Trey might be a less-than-perfect bodyguard, but I decided against it. Trey Dawson was a great fighter and would do his best for me, up to the point where he had to make a choice between Amelia and me.
So?
He said, and I realized I'd been quiet for too long.
The vampire can take the nights and you can take the days, I said. I should be okay while I'm at the bar.
I pushed back my chair and left the kitchen without saying anything else. I had to admit that instead of feeling relieved, I was even more worried. I thought I'd been so clever asking for an extra layer of protection. Instead, now I was going to worry about the safety of the men providing that layer. I got ready for bed slowly, finally admitting to myself that I was hoping Eric would put in an appearance. I'd love to have his brand of relaxation therapy to help me sleep. I expected to lie awake anticipating the next attack. As it turned out, I was so tired from the night before that I'd drifted off to sleep very quickly. Instead of my usual boring dreams, customers calling me constantly while I hurried to catch up, mold growing in my bathroom, that night I dreamed of Eric. In my dream, he was human, and we walked together under the sun. Oddly enough, he sold real estate.
This ends Disc 6. Dead and Gone, Disc 7.
When I looked at the clock the next morning, it was very early, at least for me, not quite 8 o'clock. I woke up with a feeling of alarm. I wondered if I'd had another dream, one I didn't remember. I wondered if my telepathic sense had caught something even while I slept, something wrong, something askew. I took a moment to scan my own house, not my favorite way to start the day. Amelia was gone, but Trey was here and in trouble. I put on a bathrobe and slippers and stepped out into the hall. The moment I opened my door, I could hear him being sick in the hall bathroom. There are some moments that should be completely private, and the moments when you're throwing up are at the top of that list. But werewolves are normally completely healthy, and this was the guy who'd been sent to guard me, and he was obviously, excuse me, sick as a dog. I waited until a lull in the sound. I called,
"Trey, is there anything I can do for you?"
"I've been poisoned," he said, choking and gagging.
"Should I call the doctor, a human one, or Dr. Ludwig?"
"No."
That sounded definite enough.
"I'm trying to get rid of it,"
he gasped after another bout of retching.
"But it's too late."
"You know who gave it to you?"
"Yeah, that new girlfriend."
He faded out for a few seconds.
"Out in the woods. Vampire Bill's new fuck."
I had an instinctive reaction.
"He wasn't with her, right?"
I called.
"No, she..."
More awful noises.
"She came from the direction of his house. Said she was his..."
I knew without a doubt that Bill didn't have a new girlfriend. Though it embarrassed me to admit it to myself, I was so sure because I knew he wanted me back. I knew he wouldn't jeopardize that by taking someone else to his bed or by permitting such a woman to roam in the woods where I might encounter her.
"What was she?"
I said, resting my forehead against the cool wood of the door. I was getting tired of yelling.
"She was some fangbanger,"
I felt Trey's brain shift around through the fog of sickness.
At least she felt like a human.
The same way Dermot felt human? And you drank something she handed you? It was kind of mean of me to sound incredulous, but honestly,
I couldn't help it,
he said very slowly.
I was so thirsty, I had to drink it.
He'd been under some kind of compulsion spell. And what was it, the stuff you drank?
It tasted like wine,
he groaned.
God damn it, it must have been vampire blood. I can taste it in my mouth now.
Vampire blood was still the hot drug on the underground marketplace, and human reactions to it varied so widely that drinking the blood was very much like playing Russian roulette in more ways than one. Vampires hated the drainers who collected the blood because the drainers often left the vampire exposed to the day. So vampires also loathed the users of the blood since they created the market. Some users became addicted to the ecstatic sensation that the blood could offer, and those users sometimes tried to take the blood right from the source in a kind of suicide attack. But every now and then, the user went berserk and killed other humans. Either way, it was all bad press for the vamps who were trying to mainstream. Why would you do that? I asked, unable to keep the anger out of my voice.
I couldn't help it,
he said, and the bathroom door finally opened. I took a couple of steps back. Trey looked bad and smelled worse. He was wearing pajama pants and nothing else, and a vast expanse of chest hair was right at my eye level. It was covered in goose pimples. How come?
I couldn't not drink it.
He shook his head.
And then I came back here and got in bed with Amelia, and I tossed and turned all night. I was up when when Bubba came in and went to bed in your closet. He said something about a woman talking to him, but I was feeling really bad by then, and I don't remember what he said. Did Bill send her over here? Does he hate you that bad?
I looked up then and met his eyes. Bill Compton loves me, I said. He would never hurt me.
Even now that you're screwing the big blonde?
Amelia couldn't keep her mouth shut. Even now that I'm screwing the big blonde, I said.
You can't read vampire minds, Amelia says.
No, I can't, but some things you just know.
Right.
Though Trey didn't have enough energy to look skeptical, he gave it a good shot.
I have to go to bed, Sookie. I can't take care of you today.
I could see that. Why don't you go back to your own house and try to get some rest in your own bed, I said. I'm going to work today and I'll be around someone.
No, you gotta be covered.
I'll call my brother, I said, surprising even myself. He's not going to work now, and he's a panther. He should be able to watch my back.
Okay.
It was a measure of Trey's wretchedness that he didn't argue, though he wasn't a Jason fan by any means.
Amelia knows I'm not feeling good. If you talk to her before I do, tell her I'll call her tonight.
The werewolf staggered out to his truck. I hoped he was good to drive home, and I called after him to make sure, but he just waved a hand at me and drove down the driveway. Feeling oddly numb, I watched him go. I'd done the prudent thing for once. I'd called in my markers and gotten protection, and it hadn't done me a bit of good. Someone who couldn't attack me in my home, because of Amelia's good magic, I had to assume, had arranged to attack me in other ways. Murray had turned up outside, and now some fairy had met up with Trey in the woods, compelling him to drink vampire blood. It might have sent him mad. He might have killed all of us. I guess, for the fairies, it was a win-win situation. Though he hadn't gone crazy and killed me or Amelia, he'd gotten so sick that he was effectively out of the bodyguard business for a while. I walked down the hall to go into my room and pull on some clothes. Today was going to be a hard day, and I always felt better when I was dressed while handling a crisis. Something about putting on my underwear makes me feel more capable. I got my second shock of the day when I was about to turn into my room. There was a movement in the living room. I stopped dead and took a huge, ragged breath. My great-grandfather was sitting on the couch, but it took me an awful moment to recognize Niall. He got up, regarding me with some astonishment while I stood gasping, my hand over my heart.
"You look rough today," Niall said.
"Yeah, well, not expecting visitors," I said breathlessly. He wasn't looking so great himself, which was a first. His clothes were stained and torn, and unless I was much mistaken, he was sweating. My fairy prince great-grandfather was actually less than gorgeous for the very first time. I moved into the living room and looked at him more closely. Though it was early, I had my second stab of anxiety for the day. "What's up?" I asked. "You look like you've been fighting." He hesitated for a long moment, as if he was trying to pick among several items of news.
"Brandon has retaliated for the death of Murray," Niall said.
"What has he done?" I scrubbed my dry hands across my face.
"He caught Enda last night, and now she is dead," he said.
I could tell from his voice that her death had not been a quick one.
"You didn't meet her. She was very shy of humans."
He pushed back a long strand of his pale hair, so blonde it looked white. "Brandon killed a fairy woman? There aren't that many fairy women, right? So doing that, isn't that extra awful?"
"It was intended to be,"
Niall said. His voice was bleak. For the first time, I noticed that my great-grandfather's slacks were soaked with blood around the knees, which was probably why he hadn't come closer to hug me. "You need to get out of those clothes," I said. "Please, Niall, go climb in the shower and I'll put your stuff in the washing machine."
"I have to go,"
he said, and I could tell my words hadn't registered.
"I came here to warn you in person, so you would take the situation very seriously. Powerful magic surrounds this house. I could appear here only because I'd been in here before. Is it true that the vampires and the wares are looking out for you? You have extra protection. I can feel it."
"I have a bodyguard night and day," I lied, because he didn't need to be worrying about me. He was hip-deep in alligators himself. "And you know that Amelia is a strong witch. Don't worry about me." He stared at me, but I didn't think he was seeing me at all.
"I have to go," he said abruptly. "I wanted to be sure of your well-being."
"Okay, thanks a lot." I was trying to think of an improvement on this limp response when Niall poofed right out of my living room. I told Trey I was going to call Jason. I wasn't sure how sincere I'd been about that, but now I knew I had to. The way I saw it, Alcide's favor to me had expired. He'd asked Trey to help, and now Trey was out of commission in the course of duty. I sure wasn't going to request that Alcide himself come guard me, and I wasn't close to any of his pack members. I took a deep breath and called my brother. "Jason," I said when he answered the phone.
"Sis, what's up?"
He sounded oddly jazzed, as if he just experienced something exciting. "Trey had to leave, and I think I need some protection today," I said. There was a long silence. He didn't rush into questioning me, which was strange. "I was hoping you could go around with me. What I plan on doing today," I began, and then tried to figure out what that was. It was hard to have a good crisis when real life kept asking to be lived. "Well, I need to go to the library. I need to pick up a pair of pants at the dry cleaners." I hadn't checked the label before that particular purchase. "I have to work the day shift at Merlot's.
I guess that's it.
Okay, Jason said, though those errands don't sound exactly urgent.
There was a long pause. Suddenly he said,
Are you okay?
Yeah, I said cautiously. Should I not be?
The weirdest thing happened this morning.